Okay, this is an oral history interview with Gus Schubert. Interviewer is Joe Todorovic. It is Wednesday, August 10th, 1988, at 9:57 in the morning. We're in Gus Schubert's office at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California. As I mentioned, I'd like to start this interview by reviewing a few of the things that came up in the last interview that we did, which was 2 years ago. And in that last interview, as far as your RAND experience, we talked about you're considering the job possibilities at RAND, and Ed Barlow and Bill Graham's influence in getting you here. And your early perceptions of RAND as they came to you at Lincoln Lab, and some of the early projects that you did when you first arrived at RAND. And then we discussed, towards the end of the interview, the relationship between RAND and the Air Force, some of the organizational patterns at RAND, some of the similarities and differences between what goes on at RAND and what goes on at universities. So what I'd like to do then is to pick up a few of those threads. One of the things that we discussed very briefly, and that ties in with Albert Wohlstetter's memo and concerns of 1960 as you approach the reorganization, was the difficulty in accomplishing interdisciplinary research after the 1955 reorganization. Now, Bruce Smith makes a point that the 55 reorganization was kind of centralizing and formalizing as the organization grew beyond the point where very informal and loose kinds of operations could be productive. And he sort of set the 1960 reorganization as kind of a reaction to the more rigid departmental structure that had been put in place in the intervening 5 years. And one very interesting thing that you said at the last interview, you were talking about the discussions that were going on at RAND just as you arrived about how to make a productive climate for interdisciplinary research. And you mentioned that Ed Barlow went on until he couldn't stand it anymore. This is on page 45 of the rough transcript. Ed Barlow went on in a formalistic way until he couldn't stand it anymore. We had an air defense project which followed the strategic offensive forces, which never went anywhere, and then he left. Anyone else who wanted to start an interdisciplinary project was either a fool, a hero, or both. So with that as the background, I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
By that was that the departmental structure remained very strong. It was oriented along discipline. And within that structure, there was a centering, first of all, of research leadership, and secondly, of fiscal authority, to the extent that fiscal authority was important. That is to say, money came into RAND and was channeled to the departments in departmental budgets. The department heads were the people who made the decision as to how resources were allocated in a research sense among the people of their department. And also they made the decision as to who was a good performer and who was a poor performer, and rewarded people in the salary structure in accordance with their views. Now, this is not likely to produce a lot of people who are eager to leave their departments to work in some never-never land of interdisciplinary work, economists, engineers, political scientists of various types, under the leadership of someone from another department, very often look to a department head as a person who was, quote, on leave, end quote, from his department. If we're talking about an engineer, a typical question would be, oh, yes, I know Joe Smith's a pretty good engineer. He wouldn't be here if I didn't think so, but he's been off working for Fred Hoffman on one of these big interdisciplinary projects, and I don't see any reason I should use my scarce resources to give him any kind of financial reward or incentive. So from the point of view of this individual staff member, who was then, and I hope still now, is given a lot of freedom of choice about what he does, the choice was to remain comfortably within, say, an engineering or an economics context, or to go on out and do something exotic called systems analysis or cost analysis or PERT, or work in some more or less unconventional field under the leadership of someone not in his own shop, knowing that it was likely, not certain, but likely, that the work he did would be undervalued by his department. Now, then the question comes, of course, who would value it? And I refer to those heroes or fools or both, and there were a few people like that who thought that it was extremely important to work across lines in RAND and were willing to take the risks and were, many of them, very inventive, high-quality people. Wolfstetter was one, Barlow was one, Rowan was one, Enthoven was one, Charlie Hitch, as head of the economics department, did all he could to foster that kind of work. So these people were very prominent in the RAND intellectual world, and they were willing to say there is something that this institution ought to be doing that it isn't doing, and I'm going to play a role in trying to get that done. So you had, in the earlier days, before I got here, Barlow heading large system studies, which involved different people, people from different departments, and involved him in a certain amount of risk. As I recall, however, he was a department head, so his risk was limited in the sense that he had an established place in the bureaucracy. Department head and then a division head. The fact is, that was the wrong place for him. And when it came to look as if RAND needed to take some formal step in order to encourage interdisciplinary work, Ed was taken out of the divisional structure and he was made director of projects, which was a term of art, I assume, thought up by Frank Kolbaum and Ed, to put a person in a key role in the institution to initiate, stimulate, oversee, participate in the control, the quality control of interdisciplinary work. And this all happened just as I was joining RAND, and Ed was given this job with the understanding, as he told me at the time, that he would be the first of several key people in the institution who would hold cross-departmental, cross-disciplinary leadership roles, reporting to the president, and responsible for fulfilling that part of RAND's mission, which involved cross-disciplinary, interdisciplinary research.
Okay. If I could just interrupt for a moment. To backtrack a little bit, Wallstetter, Enthoven, Hitch, Barlow, these are all pretty heavy hitters in Rand. And if they were so active and interested, if they were the heroes in the sense of trying to do interdisciplinary research during the period when it was difficult to do, or when the clouds were gathering, why did their shining example not motivate other people at Rand to follow?
Well, I think in some sense their shining example did in fact motivate other people. The record is full of the accomplishments these people made, leading interdisciplinary studies and participating in them. So, you know, you're up against a real productivity question. What's the productivity criterion for a research organization? Are you expecting everybody to work at 100% efficiency or 2% efficiency, or do you get 90% of the work out of 10% of the people, or what? I've always tended to believe that in an institution like this, you've got a leadership group, and if they're willing to take risks and they're effective, you'll get some interested and exciting new things. But they were not, these people were not, first of all, they were not united in their view as to what ought to be done. There were significant philosophical and intellectual differences, say, just for example, between Ed Barlow and Albert on the very nature of interdisciplinary work and how it ought to be pursued. I will throw in here David Novick, who had yet a third view of interdisciplinary work, and has expressed to me at the time and subsequently, his view was that the interdisciplinary work done by Rand was at best transient in value and would leave no permanent mark on the scientific establishment or on the methodology of the social science disciplines. He believed that Rand's, he said at that time, solid contributions, enduring contributions, lay in some of the achievements of John Williams' mathematics department, some of the technological analyses that were done in the engineering and physics areas, and in the creation, of course, of cost analysis as a discipline, something which David thought was very important, and which he, in fact, deserves the lion's share of the credit for formulating and leading. So you had these very good people, very energetic, extremely ambitious for Rand in effecting constructively policy in this country, who nonetheless disagreed with one another and, as I say, were far from unified. Out of that competition grew different kinds of projects, and they were interdisciplinary. There was a lot of learning involved. Some of them were uneven in quality or had soft spots, but that's to be expected. But I think the point is that these people had to pioneer against a bureaucracy in order to get that done, where the forces of bureaucratic inertia, and Rand is, I hope, better than most, but certainly no different from many, in the fact that bureaucracies tend to inhibit change and creativity. These people were struggling with the bureaucracy and trying to get it to become supportive in a way that it had not been to date, to the sorts of transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary work they wanted to do across the departments. If
I could just ask you, besides Novick, were there other people who were as vocal, fairly prominent people who were as vocal as Novick in saying that interdisciplinary research was not the place to put your energies if you wanted to do something of lasting value? Were there any other influential people that might have?
Well, I think there was a certain tradition of that sort in Rand's physics, among Rand's physicists, who concentrated really very heavily on technological aspects of military weapon systems, particularly, of course, nuclear technology. They did a lot of that work for the AEC. They were, in many ways, totally out of touch with the rest of RAND. They were, because of their special relationship with the AEC, in a separate part of the building, behind locked doors. I recall visiting in that department every time I went over there to see my buddies. It was like going off for a weekend picnic. I had to get this clearance and that clearance and get the door to open in the right direction and get let in. And as I remember, I may even have had to have an escort to sit down with Al Ladder or Dick Ladder or Ernie Martinelli or some of the other really first-class people who were over there, most of whom, by my observation, were writing relatively narrow, I'm sure quite high quality, technical analyses of weapons performance. So the Al Ladder, who sat on scientific advisory boards, and at least kibitzed with regard to some of RAND's broader studies, it was really an exception in the physics department, at least according to my recollection. Most people had their nose to a relatively narrow, specific nuclear physics grindstone. Albert, I think, went considerably beyond that in his understanding of, let's say, the procurement, employment, basing of military weapon systems, and did the best he could to translate the fundamental work he and others were doing into those policy terms. But that really was not the bag of the physics department. So you had this kind of split between the physicists, say, who were doing this sort of that sort of work, the mathematicians under John Williams, who in those early days were here only to exercise their intellectual capabilities in the manner at the time and in the area of their choice, which was typically applied mathematics. A little fundamental math, very, very little policy work. Again, there were rare exceptions. I guess so rare I can't even think of them. I think of Tom Brown, who came later, a mathematician with highly developed policy interests. I think of Ed Quaid, who, of course, was the, in many ways, the founder or one of the participating founders of the art of systems analysis. But again, they were exceptions. And the recruiting method for the mathematics department, as I may have mentioned in the earlier interview, was for John to go around the country and interview the top half dozen PhDs in math graduating that year. Line up the next half dozen for the next year, and to get three of them. And if he got three of them, he would bring them into the building and say, here you are, do whatever you want. And he believed very, very strongly that that was the way for this institution to be productive, and so on.
Now, that's very interesting, because the in talking to a number of people, you get a different picture of Williams. Williams is often cited as one of the people who encouraged breaking down disciplinary barriers, that his influence is to be seen in the very architecture of this building, because as the story has it, he influenced the design of this building so that people would be forced to walk around and bump into one another in the hallways.
John was very much a believer in the fruits of personal and professional interaction. My memory is, and this is something that should certainly be checked with people who are a lot closer to John than I was, my memory is that he did not believe that could be forced. It might be induced, It might be encouraged. There might be various processes instituted which would seduce or attract or otherwise show people the true way to nirvana, which was really taking your own excellence and bringing it together with the excellence of others. But in areas of your choice, where your motivation was highest, where your skill was highest, on a schedule by and large of your choosing, I can give you an anecdote which would be amusing that will illustrate that point, and always, I think John had, he had a great human care for everyone, but I think always John had a great intellectual care for the very best people. And he was willing to say, if I have 100 people and they're all good when they come here, my method is going to get X percent of them to achieve their own personal intellectual goals and thereby better RAND. Forced interdisciplinary research, another method. Forced leadership from a department head, a third method. Or any other method may achieve similar results, but there'll always be X minus, where the factor that's being subtracted is a considerable one. So John believed that he would have more success by giving people their own head, their own freedom, relying on their own professional integrity, rather than attempting to fit them into, force them in, into a framework where they had to deliver something Thursdays or Fridays, or they had to define their project in great detail or anything. He simply, as far as I know, did not believe in that as a team approach, although in his own work, of course, he was really quite meticulous, my memory recalls, in thinking through what it is he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it, and in planning favorable environments for the people who worked for him or with him. I think I did mention that John's great theory was that the appropriate role of a department head at RAND was to make himself mediocre. And by that he meant that it should be his constant goal to find people to bring to RAND who would be better than the department head is. And that he should always be striving to surround himself with superior intellects, superior talents, and that the more successful he was, the worse he would look in comparison to the people he brought in.
Now that's an interesting attitude that is very consistent, it seems, with Williams' approach. As Wohlstetter put it in the 1960 memo, to rely more on seduction than the shotgun for interdisciplinary work. That Williams seems to be treating every researcher as if every researcher is a supremely eminent and qualified intellect. That is, it presumes that RAND is filled with nothing but the best and the brightest, and that you should treat, or at least within his department, you should treat all of those people exactly the same way, which is to allow them the, well, it's like the MacArthur awards, where people are given a sum of money with absolutely no strings whatsoever, and it's presumed that on their own devices they will make the best of it and in somehow or another contribute.
Well, I think John was certainly more sophisticated than that would suggest. I think John knew that he would have a certain failure rate in recruiting outstanding talent, that in spite of his best efforts and the efforts of others, we'd end up with some mediocrities, at least. We'd end up with people who didn't work out, people who were flashes in the pan, and so on. So he expected failures, and he didn't, I don't think he viewed RAND as Athens, all of you would very much like to have seen that. Rather, I think he thought that of the methods available to people to get things done, the one most likely to succeed with outstanding people was the one I've just described to you, the freedom of the individual approach, let's call it. And that implies a failure rate. There's going to be a failure rate. But I think he would have argued, I think he did argue, and I believe in many ways he would have been right, that that failure rate is likely to be lower under that model than it is under one of the other approaches. Just thinking out loud, what are those other approaches? I could characterize the director of projects approach, the office that Ed Barlow held, perhaps unfairly, but maybe not inaccurately, as an engineering systems approach. When I joined RAND, I joined the Strategic Offensive Forces study, which was a joint study between RAND and the Air Force with shared, quote, leadership, end quote. As it turned out, of course, all the leadership was RAND's, but there was a forum there with the participation both of RAND researchers and Air Force people who were here either on temporary duty or worked on the project from remote sites. There was a project leadership office, which had me and Ed in it, maybe part of Albert. Bill Graham was in and out. Then the overall project, the overall study was broken up into a very large number of discrete projects. And they were engineered. That is to say, there was a project for this, there was a project for that, there was a project for the other thing. And the way the model, the implicit model of this project was that all these project leaders would get all lined up and they'd recruit from their departments with a certain amount of leverage from Ed and the department heads to get the right people. And they would start working and they would beaver away and they would meet from time to time and they would meet deadlines and there would be products produced and it would all come together and each little project would produce a piece of the overall puzzle. And then the project leaders, and Ed, and I, and Albert, and anybody else who could get in on the act, would sit down and look at those pieces and simply fit them together, and voila, there was the answer. Now, I would describe that as the engineering approach to interdisciplinary projects at RAND.
It is classic systems engineering in the way in which it was being practiced, developed and theorized about in the industry and in the engineering profession right at that time. I mean, one of the shining successes of Polaris and of Atlas and to some extent Titan, which were done in certain ways and in which the development of systems engineering as a science, as it were, appeared to be a great success. That's very interesting. I hadn't heard the Strategic Offensive Forces study described in quite that way before.
Well, I have all the advantages of hindsight, and that gives me a tremendous, tremendous accuracy. But as I think about it, it was certainly a systems engineering approach. And the next question, of course, is, did it work? And the answer is, like all other approaches, it had some successes and it had some failures. It certainly did not work in the sense that these projects all were sort of uniformly distributed over the universe in terms of quality and depth and detail and content, and they all pulled up to the finish line with a high-quality research product. In that sense, which of course is not a criterion I would apply anyway, it didn't work. On the other hand, if you read the Bible of the systems analyst and realize you have a criterion problem, and if you adopt the criterion that the quality, relevance, and influence of the study is probably the principal criterion. There are others, but I would certainly say that's the principal one. Then I would say by that criterion, the study achieved considerable success. There was, in fact, an extremely powerful overall summary of the study, which was put together by a few guys, Ed certainly, Barla principal among them, which dealt with most, if not all, of the major issues facing strategy planners, Central War strategy planners of that period, in a context where it was extremely policy relevant to the Air Force, had the courage to face up, for example, to some of the Air Force's favorite weapon systems, and as a result of the analysis was done, shown that they were simply the wrong choices to make. B-70 is a very good example of that, where the message was delivered to the highest levels of the Air Force, and I want to say they didn't like it. Some of them didn't like it one damn bit, but which is, of course, itself not a significant criterion, but it does suggest that we were delivering a message that got home to people, and I think that the study had influence. So it was an attempt to engineer or organize chaos in a productive way, and I think the end result was a very useful one. So I'm not going to quibble about whether that's the optimal way to do it. It's a way to do it, and in this case anyway, it worked. I myself have never believed in lining everybody up in a big row and trying to get them to march in step and produce a highly orchestrated, very big kind of project. I think the opportunity costs are too big you stifle too much individual creativity that way. But it is a way, and there was a tremendous creativity of Barlow, which accounted for a lot of relatively pedestrian inputs. Ed and his colleagues could look at the output of a particular project, which wasn't a very good project, and say, hey, they don't really mean that, what they really mean is this, and they ought to be doing this, and they ought to be doing that. Re-guide the project, get some useful data generated, and then use the results. That's an extraordinary talent, and Ed had it to a great degree. There's, a third model is Albert's model. And I think Albert has, throughout his career, demonstrated the validity of the power of ideas and the power of personal leadership, without much attention to bureaucracy or organizing or whether a person is a fish or fowl or a guinea hen. The problem's the thing, and the important thing is to solve the problem, and what you do is conceptualize the problem, and you talk with people you think are able and talented, and pretty soon they're interested in helping you solve the problem. And that's, at least according to my observation, one of Albert's great strengths. He's been able to assemble extraordinarily powerful and agile intellects working on problems which he has taken lead in defining. And he has then redefined, recast, put into an analytical context with the help of these people, so that they're all part of the team, the intellectual team. And when the final product is there, you never really know how much is Albert's and how much is somebody else's, but you've got a product which is really outstanding and doesn't rely at all on the formalities of, quote, the system, end quote, to get something done. So those are the Williams approach, the engineering or director of projects approach, the Albert approach. Those are all different ways of trying to get this done. And I guess one of the interesting things to note is that at that time, the bureaucracy was, as it always is, a dumb beast standing in opposition to getting new and exciting things done. And it wasn't until the, I think as we'll probably cover later in these interviews, that pendulum didn't really turn in spite of all attempts to make the director of project meaningful, in spite of the research council, which is a whole other episode in Rand's research management, which we ought to talk about. That pendulum toward interdisciplinary research enabling it through the bureaucracy didn't really start to move until the domestic division came on the scene. And then, as we will find out, it went too far. But that's probably for another time.
To just return to the Strategic Offensive Forces study for a moment, and the criterion problem. By the criterion of producing a good product and an influential product, the Strategic Offensive Forces study was a success. That is, it worked. And it was done in a kind of systems engineering way. Were there costs in terms of the personnel involved, in terms of the effect on people's morale, people who were touched by it or who got involved in it, and it was far too directed a thing for their taste?
Oh, there's no doubt that that's true, and I think in particular of one a senior RAND engineer who led one of the projects, and he was clearly in miles over his head. The subject matter was really very strange to him. He groped and groped and groped. I can remember sitting and talking with him for hours about where he was, not only where he was going, but where it is he thought he'd been. And he really didn't know, and he was put in a position which, at that time anyway, was really quite unusual for a RAND citizen to be put in. And that is, he was given a project due in an area where he was unable to get comfortable, and simply unable to produce satisfactory results. And when the project came to an end, after several redirections from the top of that project, its results were by and large useless. And that, of course, was offensive to the person who was leading the project. He didn't like that one bit, and I don't blame him. So he began to ask himself, you know, so what sort of place is this? How did I get into this mess? This is not what I came here for. I came to do this, that, or the other thing. And I think it's fair to say there were a number of such instances during the course of that project. Incidentally, I also want to mention two things. I have said that, in my judgment, on balance, that project was a success. You will have no trouble finding people who disagree with me. And some of those we've mentioned today, I would think, would be particularly informative on that subject. I think Albert Wolfstetter probably has considerably less admiration for that study than I do. And there are others who, for different reasons, who see the study's many flaws instead of the study's principal thrust, and what I consider to be its constructive influence on policy. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, on the systems engineering business, you mentioned Atlas, Titan, etc. Three observations. One is, it's no accident Ed Barlow, given his background, ended up with general supervisorial oversight over the Mercury program, with all its systems and engineering integration and so on and so forth. And I can remember concluding after working with him, and that was long after he left RAND, but working with Mercury, NASA, the Air Force Space Booster Program, all of the people who were together in that kludge, and they had achieved what I consider to be the ultimate in systems engineering. They had designed a system that if anything went wrong, would prove conclusively that you couldn't find whose responsibility it was. That's the engineering systems approach taken to its logical and absurd conclusion. The other thing is that while I was at RAND in those days, I was a part of the research and development project, which was investigating productive ways to do research and to develop weapon systems and space systems. Our general conclusions were, in fact, in opposition to the systems engineering approach. And the document, the record is well documented with heretical RAND recommendations to knock that stuff off because it's costing you a lot of money and taking a lot of time and distracting you from the real problem, which is to get something that works, that's usable. So whether that's right or wrong, it is a fact. And it's, I mean, the work is a fact. And it's something that maybe somewhere later on in this series of interviews we can talk about, because I think it's a good example of one of RAND's enduring contributions to policy.
And that is the group that you were a part of that analyzed productive ways.
Yes, productive ways for conducting research and development.
When did that activity take place? That particular group.
That group, if it is dignified with that term, a group. Was started by Bert Klein somewhere in, I would say probably 57, 58. And in other words, before I got here, I didn't join it until the early 60s. But it had some really wonderful people working on it. There was Bert himself, who exercised, I thought, extraordinary leadership and insight. A fellow named Bill Meckling, M-E-C-H, I think it is, L-I-N-G, I should know, gosh, who is an economist and left RAND, went on to become the dean of the business school at the University of Rochester. A philosopher named Emmanuel Mesthany, M-E-S-T-H-E-N-E. And in latter days, it attracted people like Tom Glennon, and who's still at RAND now, and Robert Perry, in addition to me, and a fellow named Don Lewis, who's still at RAND. That's a case of an informal structuring. Without a lot of formal participation from engineers, but a lot of palaver and discussions and writing back and forth of papers, endless disputation and arguments, bad blood all the time between the economists and the engineers about how to do this sort of thing. And it ended up, while people were angry with each other, the work clearly benefited from the heat of the exchange around the ragged edges. That is to say, there was no organizational context for engineers to join this project much, but they joined the project for the best possible reason, and that is they disagreed with what the people were saying and felt compelled to argue, and that's a very good way to get things done. So anyway, that's just for the record. We can come back and talk about that area later.
Okay, let me pause and change tapes here.
Okay.
This is the end of tape one, side one.